Again, the panel that we have, to my left is Justice Brian Walker, to my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that the parties have given their time allocations to the clerk, and we're going to do the Stickland versus Schlegel part first, and depending on how we're holding up, we might take a quick break in between, but hopefully we can just push on through, but we'll just sort of play that by ear. And I appreciate counsel's willingness to flip the time on the oral argument, because that does give us more flexibility on this. So with that, I will ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Jonathan Strickland versus Jackie Schlegel. And may it please the court, Mr. Edward Bryan to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Kelsey White to argue for the appellant.
Proceed. And since our sound system is out, I'll just ask everybody to speak up.
May it please the court. I will primarily address just two issues today, the issues of falsity and actual malice. And I'll do that from a little new angle from what's in the briefing. But first, it has to be said, it is extremely rare for a major public figure like Jackie Schlegel to survive a TCPA motion, and that's for good reason. The First Amendment and state policy leave broad room to criticize the conduct of public figures. In fact, I hope I'm right about this. I think I am. None of the cases cited by the parties actually have a public figure surviving a TCPA motion to dismiss. This is not that rare case, and here's why. Jonathan Stickland is being sued for telling the plaintiff's good friend and ally the very same thing the plaintiff herself had already told that friend. That the choice board had accused the plaintiff of stealing money by transferring money from one nonprofit to another. This is ultimately a gotcha lawsuit. The theory of the plaintiff is if we can find a clip in this longer conversation where Stickland uses the word stole, that we can extract those few words from the context and win on every point under the TCPA. The reason this case fails, and it's in the briefing, it cuts across many defamation elements, many defenses, many interesting questions of procedure, but ultimately the TCPA motion can be granted on much narrower grounds, and I'll focus on those two today. Schlegel failed to meet at step two her burdens on the issue of falsity and actual malice. And as I said earlier, I'm going to go a little bit beyond the briefing by looking at this from a little different angle. First, I'll start with the longer of these two, falsity and substantial truth, which goes right along with the issue of falsity. At step one, there's an important point, and the Weber versus Fernandez case from this Court of Appeals from 2019 really fleshes this out in a way that the parties did not discuss, neither party really discussed in the briefing, and that's that you have to determine, first of all, gist. The gist, or sometimes using almost those same letters, the sting of the statement. Not just what was said, but looking at the context, what was the gist of that statement. That's the building block you use for the rest of the analysis. Those are determined first. Weber tells us that at page 8. We determine what the gist is by construing the publication, quote, as a whole in light of the surrounding circumstances based upon how a person of ordinary intelligence would perceive it. Lipsky, the key Supreme Court case, also says that. Those are both TCPA cases. This is a legal question for the court. It's a legal question for the court. Now, where do we look for that in this case? Where do we go in the record? Here we go to one place for that. It is the Beckmeyer deposition, because that deposition lays out from the perspective of Schlegel's friend what was said over the course of several hours, and then it continued in a text chain afterwards. That is the context that we have to look at. And that deposition is non-contradictory. It's the entire story of what happened here. So the gist, if you read that deposition and do it fairly, it's that the board accused Schlegel of stealing its cash by transferring it to another entity that Schlegel controlled and did it the day before that she believed she was going to be terminated. That's the gist of the statement that Stickland made to Teresa Beckmeyer, the good friend of the plaintiff. The exact words that he said were, "Did you hear TFVC is having a problem? Jackie stole money." And then he immediately, that's the word from the witness, immediately made clear that this is just what he had learned from the board, that the board had accused her of stealing. So step two, we now have that gist. Now we're going to compare it and say, is that more damaging than a truthful publication? There are three answers to that question. They've all been brief, but they haven't been organized in this way. The first answer is that no, the gist is not more damaging than a hypothetical truthful publication, because what Stickland said is exactly what Schlegel herself told Beckmeyer 2 days before this when they had a conversation at a conservative grassroots event. Schlegel told Beckmeyer that she had transferred money between a C4 and a C3, and that the C4 board called it stealing and accused her of that. Interestingly, this is an important fact, Beckmeyer says Schlegel told her that she transferred money. So we're not weighing facts here, we're not drawing inferences. This is exactly what Beckmeyer said, and there is no contrary evidence. That is what Schlegel told her, the plaintiff told her.
So is the controversy really, and I suppose this goes to the merits in some way, I mean, it's a semantic thing. I mean, whether Schlegel was authorized to make that transfer because she was still a director and the executive director of choice versus whether it actually was unauthorized and therefore properly characterized as an attempt to steal it.
You could argue that, and if we keep this logical, that would be the next step we would reach, the exact question that you raised, Justice Kerr. But the very first question is, what if the gist is that he is simply reporting what the board has told him? And by the way, he has said, look, I didn't go question the board. I didn't look through the books and look through the bank records. These are people who I trust, who I think love Jackie Schlegel, and this is what one of them was crying, he said in his text, when I walked into the room. So the very first point before we reach those two questions is the gist of his statement that this is what the board has just told him is accused Jackie Schlegel of? And if that's the answer, we don't actually have to reach that question. But let's just say that
ignore the fact that it's a categorical statement. As long as we can look at the context of the categorical statement, we can ignore its categorical nature.
Well, I wouldn't say you ignore it, but you do have to look at the context. So
if he had said they're having trouble, Jackie embezzled money, okay? Stole, embezzled, fairly close. Mm-hmm. But we can go look at the rest of the context, and then we go, he really didn't mean he embezzled money. It was he's accused or she's accused of embezzling money. And then that's the gist of it, and then we transform a categorical statement into a completely different statement.
Well, Justice,
where do we get the authority to do that on a TCPA?
You get that authority. Let me give you an example. This case, I'm going to call it CCIG versus Harrington from the Dallas Court of Appeals from 2020. Okay, that's a case where a janitor was accused of burglary by one of the other workers. And the worker who was interviewed by the police said that she knows very well that the janitor staged a burglary in order to steal something at the workplace. And so a categorical statement. But the court looked at the entire context. That worker stated the facts upon, outside of that one statement, stated the facts upon which the worker was making the claim. And you could tell from the context that this worker was concluding as a matter of opinion that the burglary had been staged. But even though the literal words of the statement were categorical, looking at the context, it was clear that it was not. Now, That's one way to view this case. This is going to be my third point. We don't have to go that far here, though. We don't have to go that far.
The difficulty I have is this is a, you don't get to bring your lawsuit. Okay, relief, remedy, okay? And generally, it's predicated upon the fact that the court should be able to determine as a matter of law that you don't get to bring your lawsuit. But in talking about gist and context and all of these things, that's credibility determinations. That's something with regard to, that's close to a merits determination without a jury trial and being done by the court. And there's nothing in the legislative history of the TCPA that indicates that this is supposed to be a summary judgment type of situation where the court, not in a summary judgment, the court can't even do that.
But Justice Birdwell, I'm sorry, we've got Lipsky, we have the Weber case from this court, we have the CCIG case, and in fact, because of constitutional implications in a defamation case, which is only one of the TCPA-covered types of cases, the court actually does have to decide as a matter of law what was the meaning. That happens even on summary judgment. It can even happen at trial. So there are matters of law for the court. There are things that are within the court's province. And so there are, by the way, there are no credibility determinations being made here. We have no one else saying, well, actually, Jonathan Stiklin said this.
How is what did he really mean not a credibility determination?
Well, but that's not that's not exactly the question.
What did he really mean? What was the gist of his statement? What did he really mean?
Well,
that's what you're saying. How is that not a credibility determination?
But that's actually not the question. It's not what did he really mean. That becomes important on actual malice. But on the issue of falsity, the question is, what is the meaning of the words he actually said? What's the objective meaning?
I'll give you another hypothetical. Let's say there's a tone aspect to what was actually said. Okay, and is there an exclamation point at the end of it? Jackie stole money, exclamation point. Or is there Jackie stole money with a question mark at the end? How is that not a credibility determination to be made by the finder of fact, as opposed to a categorical determination of what was actually meant?
Well, but in this case, though, we don't have a question about that. We don't have that fight. We have exactly what was said, and so I don't lose my time. I want to make sure I cover on actual malice. You could disagree with me on everything about falsity, but on actual malice, the burden, again, is to prove facts showing that Mr. Stiklin either knew what he said was false, and, of course, this goes back to the two elements that Justice Kerr mentioned. He's got to know that each of those elements are incorrect, about the money moving and about the authority, or he's got to have subjective doubt, have his own doubt about that, and then basically try to avoid investigating. And again, there are no facts in either one of those. The only thing we have is conjecture from the pleading itself, and that simply cannot carry the day on actual malice. I see my time is out. If there are no more questions, I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm going to start with the global comment that we heard from Stiklin's counsel that there's no case where a public figure's defamation claim survived the TCPA. And I think this is important because it highlights what Stiklin is trying to do, which is turn the TCPA into a summary judgment proceeding before we've gotten discovery. The reason I say that is there's a Texas Supreme Court case, Casso versus Brand, where a public figure's defamation claim survived summary judgment. So if a claim against a public figure, a claim brought on behalf of a public figure can survive summary judgment, it absolutely can survive the TCPA. It is a lower burden.
But was not the distinction drawn by the court there the difference between the federal court's ability to do some fact-finding on a bench basis as opposed to the Texas rules, which do not permit a trial court to make fact findings?
Correct, Your Honor, and the affidavit in that case was deficient because it wasn't clear and specific and detailed. It didn't meet the rules, the Texas rules requirements for the type of evidence you need to overcome summary judgment. the affidavit from the defendant.
And the second question is, why do we need additional discovery here when we have the deposition of the person who actually heard the allegedly defamatory language?
Sure, Your Honor. So the area where more discovery is certainly needed, and Ms. Schlegel has a right to seek, is in the area of actual malice. So we have enough to survive the Lipsky burden that we have to offer some pleadings and some evidence on the elements of our claim, and I'm going to go through that. But with the specific and limited discovery that the TCPA authorizes, we have not had the opportunity for fulsome discovery on the types of circumstantial evidence that the court can consider on actual malice. And so what Strickland is asking the court to do is decide that Ms. Schlegel never has the opportunity to conduct fulsome discovery to support this claim. He still has a summary judgment argument he can make. We're not there yet. And what he's trying to do is require Ms. Schlegel to survive summary judgment before she's had the opportunity to gather all the evidence that she might want to defeat that claim at summary judgment. Now, the thing that we're hearing from Mr. Strickland repeatedly, and it's in the reply brief as well, is that the gist or the sting of his statement was that the Choice Board has accused Schlegel of transferring money. Those words, accused of, are nowhere in Ms. Beckmeyer's transcript. So Ms. Beckmeyer did not say that Mr. Strickland told her Ms. Schlegel was accused of stealing money. Instead, Ms. Beckmeyer testified that he said Jackie stole money, and he said it as a matter of fact. And that's at the second clerk's record at 680 to 682.
But didn't Ms. Beckmeyer know that that was what the Choice Board had said?
She knew that, Your Honor, because Ms. Schlegel had already told her. But that doesn't change the fact that he was telling her this as a statement of fact. And the effect on the listener, which we hear Mr. Strickland talk about a lot, was not an issue for this case in Vanderlinden versus Kahn, which is actually, the case factually is different, but it maps onto this case pretty neatly. And that's the case in which two neighbors who were friends, eventually one of them starts accusing the other of supporting Al-Qaeda financially. And it's a he said, she said. So that one neighbor says that he did that, he said that he did this, and he says he did not. The reason I bring it up is this court held that the defamation claims did survive the TCPA. It did not matter that there was no evidence in that opinion, there's no discussion at all about whether these business associates that supposedly heard the defamatory statements believe them or not. And in fact, that lack of evidence connecting their belief and their action on these statements is why this court decided the tortious interference claims could not survive the TCPA. So when faced with defamation claims and tortious interference claims, the evidence of effect on the listener mattered for tortious interference. It did not matter for defamation. So the fact that she knew that Schlegel had been accused of this really doesn't affect the defamation analysis at all, because she understood that Strickland was saying, as a matter of fact, Jackie had stole money. And Mr. Strickland did say in the conversation that the board had told him this. He did not say, the board told me they are accusing her of this. He said, the board has told me this. The statement that Ms. Beckmeyer says he had just told her as a matter of fact.
Okay, I've got a question here.
Sure.
So just a few minutes ago, you said it was a statement of fact. But now you're saying that he did qualify it by saying the board indicated this.
That's correct.
So isn't the full statement of fact that he's saying the board indicated to him that she had stolen?
He is saying that, but what I think is important is that Ms. Beckmeyer says that statement she's understanding as telling him factually Strickland also is saying, as a matter of fact, Jackie stole money.
That one communication, in essence, was making her understand two things. One, that the board had communicated to him that she had stolen, and two, her interpretation that he believed she had stolen.
Yes.
Even though what his statement was, the board has indicated to me that she has stolen.
Correct. And the reason we can read at the record and understand that she perceived him to be agreeing with it is that she started arguing with him about it. She said, well, have you asked the board for the facts surrounding this? And he said, no. And she said, have you called Ms. Schlegel? You're friends with her. And he said, no. And she said, well, why are you telling me this? What are you doing? You have no relationship to these entities. You're not involved in this fight. Why are you calling me and telling me these things? And later when they text, because Ms. Beckmeyer has spoken to Joel Starnes, a director of another entity, Freedom, and gotten sort of his take on everything, Mr. Stickland is texting her saying at that point, well, you need to get all the facts. You shouldn't assume Starnes is right. So he is putting his name behind the board's position that she has stolen money. The reason that's important is that it does go to the he said, she said element. I mentioned the Kahn case is about that. So when you have essentially two people fighting over whether something happened or not, they are the ones who know whether it's false or not. And so Kahn talks about how if he learned, Kahn talks about in that circumstance, the people involved in the conversation knew what was said. So you can infer they either knew it was false or knew it wasn't when they said it. Here we have Mr. Stickland's source for this information is the two other board members who knew that the transfer was stopped immediately, who also know, and we know this is in the record, Ms. Beckmeyer talks about it, that Rebecca Hardy had previously transferred money between entities unilaterally, so without full board approval.
But that was from the PAC, right? Not between the C3 and the C4.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in our pleadings, we actually talk about why this particular situation had not arisen before. It was because, and this is a two clerks record 592 and 593, fundraising was typically done through the PAC. So this legislative session was the first time that fundraising was actually done through the C4 because they were going to use it to lobby for the legislative session. So this is the first time there was a surplus of funds in the C4. Normally, there's fundraising through the PAC because it can pass money down through the other entities, or through the C3 because that's the entity that allows for tax-deductible donations. So this is a new situation. That's why there hasn't been this particular transfer before.
It's also a new situation because this was in between, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the board and Ms. Schlegel had already kind of gotten crosswise about the Huffines endorsement or whatever, and she said basically you just need to fire me. They call a special board meeting, and it's in between those two times that Ms. Schlegel decides to transfer the money into the entity that she has control over because of Mr. Starnes, right?
That is also in the record, Your Honor, but what we are arguing about all that different evidence, those are competing inferences. Those are arguments we can draw from the evidence. That's not what the TCPA is here to resolve. So at this stage, the court has to credit our inferences if they are reasonable. This is under both this court's decision in the Hall case, Dallas Morning News versus Hall, and also the Kahn case. So in the Kahn case, the court held that the defendant cannot offer evidence of falsity to rebut the plaintiff's prima facie case of I'm sorry, the defendant cannot offer evidence of substantial truth to rebut the plaintiff's showing a prima facie case on falsity, because what this court is doing is just evaluating whether we can meet our prima facie burden. There's no then going back and seeing what Mr. Stickland has to say. That might happen at summary judgment.
Because that would involve weighing evidence, and we can't weigh evidence.
Correct, Justice Birdwell. I could not agree more. I'd like to touch briefly on the CCIG versus Harrington case that counsel mentioned. I'm glad he raised it. In that case, the court did actually treat a petition, as proof under the TCPA, which we have argued is the correct analysis here. So that case supports looking at our pleadings and considering them. And the statement in that case was actually in the context of a police investigation. So the police are asking this woman at the property, what do you think happened? Who do you think did it? And she said, I think this guy did it. I think the key difference here, and this kind of gets back into malice, is that it's not at all clear why Mr. Stickland is doing this. I think, and I do think this supports a credible inference on malice. If Ms. Hardy or Ms. Wellborn were the one making this call, they're involved in running the organization. It might make sense why they are calling people and talking about this.
And this is going to the other side, devil's advocate that I am. This is clearly a matter of public concern vis-a-vis the vaccine choice, vaccine freedom community. And it is a dispute with regard to an entity and or entities in that community as to whether or not an authorized action was taken. Why is it not simply a comment by a member of the community as to what that member of the community thinks is actually going on?
It's not a comment because of the words he used and the circumstances. So if he had said, there are lots of things he could have said that wouldn't count as defamation under just plain black letter law. If he had actually said factually what happened, which is Jackie initiated a transfer from the C4 to the C3. He didn't say that, though. He said Jackie stole money, and that's important for two reasons. Stole implies the money is gone. It was not. Stole implies she didn't have authorization. That's disputed. And I think what's important that gets lost here is stole also suggests that Jackie has the money personally. And the record reflects that Ms. Beckmeyer appreciated that distinction. So what she says later in her deposition is that, no, she doesn't think it's stealing because Jackie doesn't have it personally.
Had he said Jackie misappropriated funds, that would be an accurate statement, would it not? Even if the transfer didn't go through because she was exercising some form of control over funds in a manner that she was not authorized to do. So we're going to look at the fact that he used the word stole and not embezzled and not misappropriated, but merely the use of the word stole is sufficient for him to get hailed into court on the defamation action.
Your Honor, I think that misappropriated and embezzled would be equally problematic. So I think the language that suggests that the money is gone is really part of the problem because the money was not gone. And misappropriated.
You see my point. Misappropriated, it doesn't have to be gone. It can just, it can be an improper exercise of control over funds.
I think, Your Honor, misappropriated suggests that now she has appropriated it. Right? And maybe we're just...
Well, at some point in time, she did because she authorized it, and y'all had to figure out how to get it back so that it didn't actually, the transaction didn't actually occur. But at some point in time, the transaction was in the midst of occurring.
Your Honor, it was pending and had to be stopped. It halted is one of the words used in the record.
To the point it halts, there's an appropriation. Whether it's miss or not, that's an issue.
Then I think, Your Honor, the distinction between misappropriation and stole is important, and that misappropriation would be different. The thing is, stole has a specific connotation that involves criminality. And Ms. Beckmeyer's transcript talks about how she understood stole to be imputing criminality to what was going
what
on here.
What about, this is probably a silly analogy, but I'll ask it anyway. Let's say that I say to you, Jane went to Planned Parenthood. She's committed murder. Have I defamed Jane by characterizing it that way?
Oh, well, Your Honor, that is the subject of very extensive public debate, obviously. if I may attempt to answer your question, I know my light is off.
But that would suggest criminality.
So, Your Honor, I think with that particular example, and it probably would apply here as well, and it gets to Justice Burwell's questions to opposing counsel. What people mean by certain statements at a point becomes something that has to be decided based on credibility and inferences. And so for that kind of statement to be evaluated at the TCPA stage, you know, the court would probably have to credit that there are some credible inferences that some people would consider that to be defamatory. It would probably survive the TCPA. Does it survive summary judgment? Perhaps not. But I do think keeping the preliminary stage we're at in mind here helps deal with some of the complications about how these words need to be interpreted based on a more fulsome record.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
just address both of the two key issues here again. First of all, on actual malice. I didn't spend much time on that the first time up, but there was an important statement made by Schlegel's counsel. She said, it's not at all clear why he's doing it, referring to Stickland, and said that actually supports an inference of actual malice. But that's the entire problem with the case here put on by Schlegel. We're starting off with one inference, and then we're stacking yet another inference on top of it. You don't get to do that under the TCPA. That's the problem with the actual malice argument. Another really critical point came up pretty early on. The argument was made that Beckmeyer perceived that Stickland believed that she had stolen money, and that was the problem. But now we're going to the issue of opinion here. And is it fair? Now, opinion can sometimes be actionable when someone has implied that the opinion is based on undisclosed facts that would themselves be defamatory. No one's briefed that. I know that that's the law. But here's an important point of the transcript on that. On page 43 of Beckmeyer's deposition, I asked Ms. Beckmeyer, did Mr. Stickland hold out to you that he had some information that the board itself did not have about what she had done? No. No. He was not saying, boy, wait till you really get the facts on this. I think that she stole and it's going to be bad when you dig in. Instead, if you look at the text, he's telling us why he believes the two board members. He says, I think they love her. They're trying to find a way out for her here. She's had a rough year. They want to give her a year off. They wouldn't do something like this lightly if, in fact, they've sued, which is what he was told on the phone.
Counsel, your gist and sting argument depends upon the credibility of Ms. Beckmeyer.
Justice Bobo,
It flat does. But, and in this instance, on this record, because I don't think we've got the video of her deposition, it depends upon her credibility on a piece of paper.
Well,
and somehow we're supposed to be determining whether or not her perception of what was said is one way or the other based upon how it's transcribed on a piece of paper.
Justice Burwell, maybe I can put it this way. Under the TCPA, the non-movement has a chance to ask for discovery, for more discovery. They could have asked for discovery on actual malice. They didn't do that. Instead, what they said is, we're just going to file the new petition the same day our response is due, and we're going to pack it with everything that we think we've got, and that's what the court has to accept. And it was full of these kind of political allegations against Mr. Stickland. So they had a chance to do it. No one here has attacked the credibility of Ms. Beckmeyer. We don't have that clash here. You're not hearing two different sides. We have the complete transcript.
You're arguing that her statements are an admission by a party opponent because you characterize her as a friend of Ms. Schlegel. Okay? And I understand the argument. My point is that still requires weighing by the finder of fact. As to whether is, she's friend, so maybe I should take that statement as more probative with regard to what was meant under the circumstances, but I'm still weighing evidence under those circumstances.
I'll give you 30 seconds to respond to that since your time is up.
Okay. Well, respectfully, there are not two sides on what she said. And in fact, there are not two sides on the key question of not just on what she said, but this idea of whether money was moved. There's no evidence in the record on those key points about money being moved or not. I mean, the evidence has actually come from our side on that. And so this is not a point where you've got to weigh two different things. The burden is here on this side to come forward with at least a prima facie case. They haven't done so. Thank you.
If I may, Justice Kerr.
Briefly.
Y'all, and this is not a question, this is directed to both parties. On November 23rd, this court issued an opinion called Bookout versus Shelley. Okay? Deals with very similar issues. There's a reason why I was using the word embezzled is because it deals with it. It's our good friend and colleague, Justice Basil, who's all over this record with all these different cases. It's one he issued. And it goes into detail with regard to what was a extrinsic defamation claim with regard to embezzlement. And I would, y'all clearly, I didn't bring it up because I didn't want y'all to have that opportunity to go, well, I'm not really familiar with that. But it issued, and y'all need to look at it. And I would ask that if this is up to her, but if y'all need to explain it to us how it might apply under these circumstances, y'all might want to do that.
Well, you're certainly free to ask permission to submit post-argument briefing, letter briefing, but while we're talking about other things, I know that there had been an unsuccessful mediation attempt in the trial court. I mean, is there any possibility on all sides of this that y'all could make another run at it, or have you?
Well, you're correct, Your Honor. We had an entire day of mediation with all of the parties. Everybody participated in good faith. I mean, we would love to not be sued for defamation, but the issues really involve the two entities, and I can't speak to them.
Oh, sure. I'm not asking for anybody to divulge anything, but to the extent that it might be possible after today, we would just encourage y'all to consider trying it again. But anyway, thank you.
I would say this, just to maybe save time, we would like to submit a brief on this case. I say that without having read it, and I thought, having shepherdized all the cases in my prep, I guess it wasn't through yet. But we would like to do that.
We would also like to do that with the court's permission.
Since Justice Birdwell brought
it
up,
I guess it. I'm sorry about that.
I can't say no.
Thank you.
She'll get me back later.
Yeah. All right.
Really? Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to read it. So.
Yeah. Really. Okay. Shall we keep?
I'm fine.
You okay? Do you need?
I'm okay.
Okay. All right. Well, then we'll just stay here while the lawyers are rearranged.
Your Honors, would you like us to move now that we're becoming the cross appellant, or is it okay?
It's yeah. Up to what? Oh.
We'll just
whatever. Okay.
Oh. She didn't ask us to move.
Okay, so even though this is the same cause number and everything's just a cross appeal, but I'll ask the clerk just to make sure that our record is straight to announce the parties in this second half.
The court will now call the cross appeal, Jackie Slagle and Al versus Texas for vaccine choice, and Mr. Ian Marshall, Senator, to argue for the appellant. Ms. Jillian Schumacher to argue for the appellees, and also Ms. Ellen Peebles to argue for the appellees.
Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Sander.
May it please the court. There are three categories, I think broad categories of issues in this appeal. One is timeliness, one is application, and then one is the prima facie burden that cross appellee has. I'm going to try to address all three of those, but we'll obviously answer any questions that the court has. So on timeliness, I think the first issue is an easy one, and there is no challenge to the PAC motion being timely. The only challenge on timeliness here involves Schlegel and Freedom. And there are a few ways that cross appellee argue that Schlegel and Freedom's TCPA motion was untimely. The first one is that there was a TRO issued in this case, which Schlegel and Freedom's counsel signed and agreed to as form only. And there are cases from Texas courts that say a form-only agreement does not constitute a general appearance. One of those cases is Exchequer Financial Group out of the Dallas Court of Appeals. The TRO can't be a linchpin for general appearance here, either because it is void. It doesn't comply with the mandatory requirements of TROs under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And again, there are many cases that say that noncompliance renders those orders void, not merely voidable. There's one case, it's in regards to San Antonio, that says an agreement to avoid order is no agreement at all. So the TRO can't be a linchpin for freedom in Schlegel having appeared. So the next argument is that Schlegel and freedom signing a Rule 11 agreement somehow constitutes a general appearance. And that, again, is, as a general matter, is not the rule. Here, there was a Rule 11 agreement signed in December. It was not filed with the court until after Schlegel and Freedom appeared and voluntarily answered. And yesterday, there was a letter filing. And Cross-Appellee cites a case, Ventura. And in Ventura, the court found on that specific facts, or those specific facts, that a Rule 11 agreement constituted a general appearance. But that Rule 11 agreement is distinguishable from ours here. One way is that there was no written, my clients did not file any written instruments with the court seeking relief. But in Ventura, the Rule 11 required the defendants there to file a written instrument asking the court to order mediation, which the court did. So that is a step further than we have here, and it's an ask for affirmative relief. Also, the Rule 11 in Ventura is explicitly subject to further order of the court, which the court in Ventura explained was recognizing the court's authority. Here, the Rule 11 has no language that is subject to the official order. So that gets to the final linchpin that they have, which is Schlegel and Freedom's counsel showing up at a TRO hearing and opposing the TRO itself constitutes a general appearance. We cite a case, Turner v. Turner, which holds the opposite, which says merely opposing a TRO cannot constitute a general appearance. Cross-Appellee cites a few cases that have the opposite holding. None of these cases, by the way, are Fort Worth cases. But the three cases they cite are Kaufman, Hogg, and Vertex. Kaufman holds that in each of those three cases, the defendant is doing something more than just opposing a TRO. In Kaufman, they asked the court to enforce a Rule 11 agreement on the record. In Hogg, the defendant ends up agreeing to the TRO and agrees without any limitation to just form. So it's form and substance. And then in Vertex, which is a federal court case, the plaintiffs served the petition via email. They had a TRO hearing. And then later, the plaintiff's counsel asked defense counsel if that email service would suffice, and defense counsel said it would and waived formal service. That is not the case here. In fact, if you look at the record, and it's volume 4 at 2092, there are emails after the TRO hearing from Vaccine Choices Counsel saying, we haven't served you yet, but we need to. I'm holding off for now. If you also look at their contemporaneous conduct, they didn't move for default. They didn't file their initial disclosures, which would have been due had there been a general appearance. So nothing, I think, in the court record shows that any party thought a general appearance was entered. There's cases saying there wasn't. But the final point I want to make on this, too, is that if the court were to go against us on this point and hold that merely opposing a TRO constitutes a general appearance, there are negative policy implications of that. It puts some defendants in a hard spot of deciding, do you show up sometimes the same day to oppose a TRO and waive potentially filing a special appearance, which needs to be a verified pleading, or do you let a TRO, often overbroad, be entered against you? Another negative policy implication is that plaintiffs would be incentivized to file TROs just to shortchange or short-circuit having to effectuate service, which is a fundamental part of our due process.
Okay, the reason serve is important is because the 60 days runs from service, correct?
Correct. Or it's
And the statute itself doesn't specifically define service as anything other than what's understood pursuant to the rules of civil procedure, correct? It effectively incorporates the rules of civil procedure.
Correct.
Okay. So we've got electronic service. Okay, so when did each of these parties start accepting service of documentation through electronic service?
February 11th, when all three parties appeared and voluntarily answered the petition, which was filed and pending.
Well, but that's appearing, okay? Service was January 31st, was it not? That's
sure.
That's when the first amended added the PAC, wasn't it?
There wouldn't have been electronic service on Schlegel or Freedom because they had not generally appeared yet.
So you're basically, the record does not reflect that they received service of any document ever filed with the 17th District Court up until that point in time through the electronic service, electronic filing.
So I believe what the record would show is that
every time the other side files something electronically, they were sending it by email or something like that, and there was no actual service.
So I believe the record reflects that Schlegel and Freedom's formal counsel had filed a vacation letter with the court. So I believe that counsel would have been on the e-service list. But just like agreeing to a TRO's form only, filing a vacation letter does not constitute a general appearance.
And you don't find anything significant about the vacation letter, because wasn't that before the PAC was added?
It was. So, I don't think any of this really involves the PAC, because that council never...
Right. But I don't know why parties, council, who hadn't entered an appearance or hadn't been served would be filing a vacation letter, but...
Right. I share that question, but I think the case law shows that's not a general appearance and doesn't substitute for it.
So the filing of the first amended petition is of no effect one way or the other, because the three defendants just showed up on February 22nd and said, we're now answering.
It was February 11th, but yes.
February 11th,
yes.
I'm sorry. And they filed it with regard to the electronic filing system?
Yes. Court records are public. We were obviously aware that the lawsuit existed. We were part of the Rule 11 agreement, Schlegel and Freedom. So it's not, the argument isn't that we weren't aware of the petition. It's...
My point is this, is through the electronic service, the clerks can see who's getting served through the electronic service, okay? So if, in fact, that document through the electronic service is being sent to the three defendants to their designated counsel through the electronic service, why is that not some evidence that that appearance had already been made?
Sure. One clarification in the answer. It would just be the two defendants, Freedom and Schlegel. The PAC was not represented by the formal counsel, so anything he would have received would not have been relevant to the PAC. But I think where perhaps we're getting hung up is Freedom and Schlegel have never been served with the citation, which is what triggers service under the rules. And so a copy of the petition via email or electronic service is the same as if a counsel had emailed Freedom and Schlegel's counsel, but that's not the citation, which is what starts the service or the answer requirement.
Unless somebody voluntarily appears.
Exactly.
Okay.
I will save the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, my co-counsel and I intend to split this oral argument. I'm principally prepared to address the applicability of the TCPA, the late filed TCPA motion, and the exemptions, while my co-counsel is principally prepared to address our evidence in the record of our prima facie case for each of our claims. I want to clarify a couple things quickly on timeliness and then move to the TCPA applicability. First, cross-appellants argue that the TRO was signed as to form only, but the TRO itself states that it's an agreed TRO, and the trial court's order on the TRO says A couple things. First, the TRO itself indicates that counsel appeared and argued, and the TRO order states, in light of the party's agreement, this TRO is granted. And so the record shows the parties at that hearing sat down and they agreed to that TRO. Then the parties entered into a Rule 11 agreement. The Rule 11 agreement required Cross Appellee not to seek any temporary relief in the trial court until the parties mediated. Those actions recognized that an action was properly pending. It's important for this court to note, we're not asking, there's no policy determination at issue. There's no question of what is the best rule in this context. The Supreme Court of Texas precedent is binding on this court, and it states that a party generally appears any time it invokes the judgment of the court on an issue other than jurisdiction, or by its actions shows that an action is properly pending or seeks affirmative relief. The question before this court is just a factual application. Did any of this conduct suggest that Cross Appellants invoked the judgment of the court on a matter other than jurisdiction or recognized that an action was properly pending? Now, there's one case cited by Cross Appellee. That case is not good precedent even in the 14th District where it was issued. It's been distinguished, and other courts in Texas have noted that that case is not good law. It's not good law in Texas. But in their reply brief, Cross Appellee argues, they say, we are not arguing that you can never generally appear at a TRO. That statement is in the reply brief. They just say, but there was no general appearance here. But there's no authority that holds what extra step you have to take at a TRO hearing to generally appear. In the Beistel opinion, written by Justice Jane Bland, simply making an objection was sufficient for an appearance. Now, that wasn't in a TRO context, but there's no rule here for how the TRO proceeding was different. So we would submit that under Texas law, the parties generally appeared. Additionally, under the plain language of the statute, the first amended petition shows that it was served on counsel for Cross Appellants. If the court has no further questions on this issue, I'll move to the TCPA's applicability to this case. Chapter 27.003 says that the TCPA applies only to a case that is based on or in response to a protected constitutional right. In this case, the rights that they assert are the right to free speech and the right to association. Now, it's important in determining whether or not the TCPA applies that Cross Appellants had the burden to prove the application of the TCPA. And that matters because we have a general pleading here, and there were no special exceptions filed in the trial court. And you see in their reply brief, they concede certain theories of liability, but they don't direct the court. So under, for example, the breach of contract claim, in their reply brief, they say, well, we didn't move on this particular theory of liability. If you look at the reporter's record, they made the same argument in the trial court. They said, we're not moving on any theory of liability that relates to the failure to return confidential information. But their papers suggest that none of our claims should survive. They asked the court to dismiss all of our claims, and they don't parse through the pleading and explain what theories of liability survive and what don't. The court is left to determine what is the heart or the basis of the claims.
Counsel, my understanding of your argument in reading the briefs is essentially that if we're dealing with individual communications, we're dealing with and individual associations, we're dealing with constitutional rights, but there's no constitutional right to communicate with somebody else's means of communication. And that's borne out by the exemptions with regard to trade secrets that have been specifically carved out, that I can't communicate using your email. I can't communicate using your logo. I can't communicate using your trade name or any of your trade secrets one way or the other. So I have a constitutional right to communicate, but that constitutional right I will have you know, effectively punched you in the face by using your stuff, and so I've gone past where I'm protected constitutionally. Is that accurate in terms of your argument?
That's correct. Our argument is that the use specifically of our trademark is not a communication of public concern under the TCPA, that using our materials is not a communication of public concern under the TCPA. And this court can look to its precedent in the Fair Hat case, which we cited in our brief. In that case, we had two private entities who were competing. And as so employees left an organization and went to start a competing business. The court concluded that there were communications relating to the starting of the new business that may have implicated the TCPA. There were portions of those communications. But this court said that's not the basis of the claim. The claim is the way in which you competed. You competed by taking our confidential information. The same is true in this case. And so that's a good case that's instructive for this situation. This court's opinion in Total Gen Services case, which we also cite in our brief, in the fourth footnote, and we didn't highlight this footnote as much as we could have, but in the fourth footnote, the court notes that in the Second Court of Appeals, there's a split between communications that are evidence of claims and the basis of claims. So there can be communications involved in a suit that relate to a topic of public concern, but they may not be the basis of the claims. In their reply brief, they talk a lot about the fact that they say we need to look at what the suit was filed subsequent to. A brief history of the facts as to what happened before our suit was filed provides an illustration of how this analysis should work. Last November, Ms. Schlegel was terminated from Choice. She was terminated because she stole 80% of our organization's assets. That termination triggered a non-disclosure agreement. The non-disclosure agreement required her to return our confidential property and avoid conflicts of interest, such as stealing 80% of our funds. Rather than comply with her agreement, the record shows that...
But in saying she stole, you managed to get her before she walked out of the Walmart.
Actually, the record shows...
That's attempted theft, or...
The record shows that the transaction went through, and then we were able to reverse it. So we caught her in the parking lot.
And brought it back in.
Okay. Right. Anyway, the only statement that had occurred before our original petition was filed, our general counsel had emailed our vendor, who used our platform to send communications to our donors under our name, and she had stated no further communications from Choice until further notice. The vendor sent an email to Ms. Schlegel and a third party, Mr. Matt Langston, and he said, what would you like me to do in light of Choice's email? Would you like me to simply rename Choice's list to Freedom? And the response is telling. They said, no, don't change the name to Freedom. I want a Thanksgiving message going out from Jackie as executive director of Choice. And that Thanksgiving message was sent out. Now, the Thanksgiving message happened to talk about vaccines, but if it had simply said Happy Thanksgiving, we still would have filed suit, because this suit has never been about silencing Ms. Schlegel. Our claims don't do that. That's not the impact of our claims. We simply want the return of our own organizational assets. Briefly, so the court has four different ways to affirm the trial court's order. The court only needs to buy or accept one of our arguments. So, and to reverse this opinion, you would need to reject all four of our arguments. The arguments are that the TCPA was filed late, that the TCPA doesn't apply. We also argue that our claims are specifically exempt from the TCPA. The legislature has created an exception to the TCPA for business claims like the claims asserted in this case. Section 27.010.50 states that it does not apply to claims arising from an officer, director, or employer-employee relationship that seek recovery for misappropriation of trade secrets or corporate opportunities. In our briefing, and this court has to look at the plain language of that statute, we've cited a case in which a court found derivative liability. In that case, under the fraud exception, and it's the Baylor, Scott, and White case, which is cited in briefing by the parties extensively, but we added in our letter yesterday. The court found that an unjust enrichment claim fell under the fraud exception. So that's an
Let me ask you this. We have to presume the legislature uses words specifically. They use the word trade secret. They did not use the word intellectual property. Intellectual property, you would agree, would be a more broad encompassing situation. Has any court interpreted trade secrets or business opportunity to include an email list?
No, Your Honor. There is no authority in Texas on that point one way or the other.
That's what you're asking us to interpret here.
If you reach that argument.
Getting to the exemptions.
If you reach that argument, yes. And I would like to turn it over to my co-counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As my co-counsel had noted, I'm addressing the second portion of the court's analysis, whether Choice submitted clear and specific evidence of a prima facie case for its causes of action. There's not enough time to address each cause of action and the underlying elements in this case, but I submit to you that the record demonstrates that Choice has satisfied its burden. There are three points I'm hoping to address with you in the limited time we have. First, refocusing the analysis under the applicable burden. Second, responding to cross-appellant's damages argument. And third, addressing cross-appellant's inaccurate statement that there can be no tortious interference with a nonprofit's revenue or donations. First, as this court is well aware of the applicable standards, I'd just like to refocus the argument as to what the TCPA does not require here. It does not require that our evidence be uncontroverted. It does not prohibit use of circumstantial evidence. It does not require us to prove our claims on the merits. And it does not require this court to resolve or even determine if there are any fact issues in this case at this stage. Cross appellants raise many points in their brief that are ultimate determinations for the fact finder. But the only proper consideration at this time is whether Choice has submitted a prima facie case. Second, with respect to damages, cross appellants argue that Choice has not set forth cognizable damages, but that is factually inaccurate based on the record. The Texas Supreme Court has explained that direct evidence of damages is not required, but the evidence must be sufficient to allow a rational inference that some damages naturally flowed from the defendant's conduct, and that a party who breaks this contract cannot escape liability because it is impossible to state or prove a perfect measure of damages. The Texas Supreme Court has directly addressed what constitutes sufficient prima facie damages under the TCPA in two cases cited in our brief. In the 2015 N. Ray Lipsky case, which has been discussed at length in this argument and the prior argument, and also in the 2018 Elliott case.
But isn't the damages issue wrapped up with the context in the context of whether or not soliciting donations constitutes a business opportunity or actually conducting business?
Yes, Your Honor, and no. I think that
the point is because people make their donations freely. There is no actual contract with regard to that. This is a gift. It's treated as a gift. Then how are we to treat that as a business opportunity under the TCPA?
Well,
or damages for that matter.
Sure.
Because people could just quit giving next week.
Right. And I think the significant distinction there, Your Honor, is we're not suing our donors to enforce a contract. We are suing Ms. Schlegel, the PAC, and Freedom for their collective action in diverting donations away from Choice. I do think they seem to argue that there can be no contractual damages for lost donations. But again, that might be true if we were suing our donors. We're not suing our donors. And if the court were to rule that a nonprofit's damages model could never include loss of donations, I mean, that would be some new precedent as far as I'm aware, because cross appellants have not cited anything to that nature in their briefs.
I'm assuming there's some type of case law that says that C3s and C4s and PACs are business organizations under the Business Organizations Code or something of that nature?
That is not something we got into in our briefs, Your Honor, but there is a case, if you don't mind me going just a second over and grabbing.
That's up to her. I'm sorry. And this I'm sorry, y'all. She forgot to bring my shock collar.
Yes. I'll give you 30 apologies. Seconds.
So I don't have time to get into cross-appellant's characterization of the Archer versus Anderson case, but there is an interesting distinction that this Texas Supreme Court makes in that case with respect to inheritances versus business opportunities. And the court said when there's an unlawful interference with commercial or business opportunity, the tort law recognizes a remedy, and a remedy is warranted because the defendant's unlawful behavior impeded the plaintiff's liberty interest, which is an interest in pursuing productive activity free from wrongful interference. Donations are the revenue for a nonprofit, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have a few points I want to hit, and I'm kind of going to start backwards and start with the idea of donations and contracts under tortious interference. Cross-Appelli said that they are not suing the donors, and that is a key point here, because under tortious interference with existing contracts, there has to be a contract that could have been breached. Donations aren't contracts. There's no consideration. And for the same reason, and also additional reasons, tortious interference with prospective contracts, if there is no business relationship that is cognizable under law, there is no tortious interference there. So that was one point I wanted to make. The next point is I want to talk about exemptions, and I think their exemption argument turns on whether this case is about the misappropriation of trade secrets and business opportunities. There are no trade secret allegations here. In fact, between the first petition and the second petition, which is the one we're challenging, they dropped a misappropriation of trade secrets claim. And I think that is telling, and as some of the questions picked up on, trade secrets does not encompass just anything anyone says. It's a term of art under the law. But I also think if you look at the...
Let me ask you a question then, okay? They're relying on the nondisclosure agreement, and a specific term of the nondisclosure agreement is that Ms. Schlegel will not use the logo for choice, even if she had something to do with creating it. So is she not effectively stopped from saying that that's not some form of trade secret or confidential business information with regard to that? It might not meet the technical definition of trade secret, but she has acknowledged with the contract that, in fact, it is a confidential property of choice as opposed to some generally, because the argument I understand now is the logo is just, no, it's not trademarkable, et cetera, type of thing, but doesn't she effectively say it is by agreeing to that?
So my answer is no, trade secrets and confidential information have distinct meanings under Texas law, and I don't think a public-facing logo and name could be a trade secret. I would also point, this is a little out of order, but I would point out that we aren't challenging every claim that Choice brought in the underlying lawsuit. If the court were to grant all the relief we're seeking by reversing the three parties' TCPA motions, there are still actions pending against Ms. Schlegel in the trial court, and those are the ones that don't trigger the constitutionally protected rights here. But I do think we need to look a little bit at what their pleaded allegations are. If you look for the four declaratory judgment requests, two of them have nothing to do with the Choice logos or trademarks. They're asking that Texans for Vaccine Freedom not be allowed to operate under that name, and they cite no authority for why that's they would be entitled to that relief. They're also asking for the court to declare that Choice has a right to control the PAC, which is an independent entity which was created before Choice was. Those requests for relief have nothing to do with whether Ms. Schlegel used email lists or used Choice's logo or not. One comment on the Baylor Scott case. We concede that the exemptions for misappropriation of trade secrets and business opportunities can go beyond a trade secret claim. But what Baylor Scott says is that the misappropriation of trade secrets has to be an essential element that you have to prove as part of the claim. That would be arising under. But here, if you look at trademark infringement, tortious interference, they don't have to prove that's a trade secret to prevail on their cases, and that's why those claims don't fall within the exemptions. Two final points, and these are on timeliness. One is an objection is a request from the court. There was a case that, and a notion cited by Choice, that a party generally appears if they make an objection at a TRO hearing. An objection is different than merely opposing and arguing against the merits of something. And then finally, there's a case, we cite it in our opening brief, Grant, it's out of the court in Austin, and it goes to when a motion is timely, and it's 60 days after voluntary answer, or if the party's not served with process. And so that's how you can kickstart that 60-day process if you're not served with process. We would ask the court to reverse.
All right. Thank you very much. The oral arguments all around have been very helpful. We appreciate it. Again, it would be nice when y'all submit your letter briefs if it has a – oh, we're going to work this out, but it's up to y'all. All right. With that, we will stand in recess.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
Thank you.